Journalism History, a podcast that rips out the pages of your history books to re-examine the stories you thought you knew and the ones you were never told. I'm your host, Terry Finneman, guiding you through our own drafts of history. This episode is sponsored by the Texas Christian University Bob Schieffer College of Communication, where students learn to practice journalism with the persistence, civility, and integrity embodied by legendary CBS News journalist Bob Schieffer. The nation will celebrate the 100th anniversary of women having the right to vote in 2019 and 2020. But what many people don't realize is there was a powerful counter-movement that worked for decades to prevent women from getting the right to vote, and that many of those protesters were actually women preventing the expansion of their own rights. We've created 5 mini-episodes featuring suffrage researchers who spoke at an American Journalism Historians conference. This is part 2. In this episode, I'll discuss the press and the anti-suffrage movement. So today, I'm going to focus my talk on the anti-suffrage movement and focus in particular on the year 1917, which was a critical turning point for both the suffrage and anti-suffrage movements. I'm really interested in taking a look at how the press covered a counter-movement that was on the verge of defeat. But before I talk about 1917, I want to back up and talk about the history of the anti-suffrage movement. So we're familiar with 1848 in Seneca Falls, which is considered really the launching point of the suffrage movement. But from 1848 until the 1890s, you really don't see any kind of formal organization of the anti-suffrage movement, because really, anti-suffrage feelings were very widespread, so they didn't really find it to be relevant to have any kind of formal organization because nobody really took this very seriously on a broad scale. It wasn't until the 1890s that you start to see these formal anti-suffrage organizations established, particularly in Massachusetts and New York. As the anti-suffrage were increasingly threatened by the range of progressive movements at the turn of the century. So you start to see different kinds of propaganda and public relations materials, like pamphlets, letters to the editor, advertisements, start to come out promoting anti-suffrage messaging. So one of the most popular messages, of course, and this appeared in 1894, was the argument that God himself created men and women separately, and they need to stay separate, right? That there are different spheres for each of them. So you have this pamphlet specifically saying the creator made man and woman to govern, but in totally different spheres and methods, okay? So you have this religious argument as to why women should not be allowed to vote. Then in 1895 in Massachusetts, you have another pamphlet arguing that we submit that woman's suffrage will not promote the happiness or physical welfare of women. That is, you know, it doesn't help her social and moral elevation. Okay. So you start to see this argument that women are more moral. It's not going to make them any happier. Why should we add this burden to them when it's not going to help womanhood? Okay. Then you also start to see, of course, whenever you have arguments, some kind of ridiculous counter-framing. So in 1896, you have an argument that what if it rains or snows or the baby is ill or one of the members of the family is an invalid? You know, what's going to happen then? Will the men drive to the polls and back and then the women have to go separately? And, you know, what if there aren't enough horses? There simply are not enough horses for both men and women to go to the polls to vote. Okay, so again, you have these kind of extreme reactions of people kind of grasping at straws in this case, trying to argue that it would just be chaos and women should not be allowed to vote. Another strategy is similar to the kinds of Facebook memes that we see today, where you pull in comments from prominent people, in this case, Thomas Jefferson and Daniel Webster, And you take quotes from them to create your advertisement to argue against your case, why women should not be allowed to vote. Okay, so this gives you some idea of the different strategies used in the 1890s in the early phase of the formally organized anti-suffrage movement. So by the time you get to Christmas 1916, the anti-suffragists are feeling really pretty good. The 1910s have often been referred to as the doldrums for the suffrage movement. They lacked much momentum. They didn't gain a lot of rights in various states. They were working on a state-by-state movement at that time, trying to get women the right to vote. Didn't have a lot of success. And so by Christmas 1916, you have Josephine Dodge, who was the leader of the anti-suffrage movement at that time, really feeling pretty good. There's a quote of her in a newspaper article saying that suffrage is beaten, they will never get another state. At this point, the National Association opposed to woman suffrage had 25 state associations with 350,000 members. So by the end of 1916, they're feeling pretty good with their cause, but then 1917 rolls around, and 1917 was really a critical turning point for women's suffrage, and here are some of the key historical factors that happened that year. One of them was that Jeanette Rankin, a Republican from Montana, became the first woman elected to Congress. So that made a tremendous dent in the argument that women were not qualified enough or capable enough of being involved in national politics when you see the glass ceiling broken as far as women in Congress. Another huge, huge moment in 1917 was the state of New York agreeing to grant women the right to vote. This had been really a stronghold for the anti-suffrage movement, a major eastern state. The importance of this cannot be, overstated. And then another critical thing that happened in 1917 was the United States entering World War I. And with men going to serve abroad, you had a lot of women stepping up to fill jobs at home, showing once again that women could handle, quote unquote, men's work. And we'll come back to this war theme later. So other critical points in 1917 is you also have really strong leadership at the suffrage movement level. You have Carrie Chapman Catt and Alice Paul, who had very different approaches to getting women the right to vote. Carrie Chapman Catt appreciated more of a moderate approach, while Alice Paul aimed for more of a radical approach. Both of their approaches, working at the same time, were very, very effective for moving women's suffrage along. So let's talk a little bit more about social movements. So social movements are voluntary collectives that people support in order to affect change in society. They are seeking media attention, public awareness, and policy and societal change. Whereas counter movements are conscious, collective, organized attempts to resist or reverse social change. They tend to emerge when social movements show progress, when they see social movements as a perceived threat, and when they start to gain political allies. So the goal of a counter movement is to undermine and neutralize a social movement and its progress. In general, there tends to be a lot more focus on the social movement itself instead of the counter movement, which is why I was interested in taking a look at the counter movement. So counter-movements tend to be very narrow in scope and really more so reactive opposition instead of being proactive. They tend to be very negative. They dig up societal myths to try to keep the status quo, and they are very much about status preservation. And so in the case of the anti-suffrage movement, you really see women fighting against the extension of their own rights. So the goal of my research is to increase understanding of press portrayals of counter-movements, to study non-feminist perspectives in more depth, to analyze local and regional papers, And I ended up looking at almost 400 articles from 36 states and Washington, D.C. as part of my project. And I was really taking a look at what arguments used by the anti-suffragists did the press focus on in its coverage of the counter-movement in 1917, and then what arguments did the suffragists use to discredit their opponents. So what I ended up finding is that World War I was really, really dominant in the coverage. There was a lot of emotional and fear-raising tactics used by the anti-suffragists, who argued that there needed to be a focus on patriotism and that the women suffragists were very, very selfish for wanting their own rights when we needed to put the country above our individual needs at this time. So they accused the suffragists of being very anti-patriotic and used that as an insult. And use the war again for fear raising. They really emphasize how much of a burden it would be for women to have to vote. And you really see this emphasis in press coverage on what the national leaders of the anti-suffrage movement thought. You really did not see, even though these were local and regional newspapers, you did not see them going out and interviewing local and regional people about why they were part of the anti-suffrage movement, why they supported it. Instead, stories focused on quoting these national leaders instead. And so you really see the absence of any kind of complexity as far as race, class, religion, education, conservatism versus progressivism, and again, this absence of local and regional beliefs. And so one of the issues that the anti-suffragists had is that they were very contradictory. So they accused the suffragists of being very selfish and lobbying during wartime when they shouldn't be. But then the anti-suffragists were also lobbying during wartime to criticize the suffragists. And so they were very hypocritical to criticize their opponent for one thing while they were doing the same thing. They had this theme of America First, which should sound familiar to us today. This was a common theme 100 years ago already, with the anti-suffragists saying we really need to put America first, not our individual needs. They accused suffragists of being pro-German, socialist, and pacifist, again, trying to play on fear-mongering during this time. They referred to women having the right to vote as being a menace with evil effects. So, again, you have these very scary words that they're using. They referred to suffragists as enemies of the people. Again, language we're seeing still today. They accused them of being very disloyal. There was a quote by one of their leaders saying, "We must arouse every real American man and woman to this menace of this triple alliance: socialism, suffragism, and pacifism." Okay? So this is something that people needed to be afraid of, women having the right to vote. Shifting to the theme about a burden and how much a burden it would be for women to have the right to vote, there were quotes in newspapers saying, "This would be to double the time, the energy, and largely increase the money used in elections. This would be a needless economic waste. The extra burden during wartime would be a grave menace to the country." Anti-suffragists argue about states' rights, and we still have discussions about states' rights today, that states should be able to decide this, not the federal government. And overall, you just see, again, a lot of very emotional arguments. And so with the suffragists, there was really a contrast in their press coverage because it focused a lot on reasoned arguments and facts instead of playing into this emotional type of game. And they pointed out how the anti-suffragists were very contradictory and irrational. And so they pointed out that suffrage received far more votes than the socialist candidate for mayor in New York. So they basically fact-checked that. You can't accuse us of socialism because suffrage received way more votes than the socialist candidates did. So it's not just socialism that's behind this.
They argued that states needed to ratify changes to the constitutions, and individual states would get their say. So that was their way of countering the states' rights argument. And then they would make comments about how, well, we are working so well together with the anti-suffragists during wartime. Women are doing their part. So they used a little bit of reverse psychology here as well to point out, you know, women can do things. Women are making a tremendous contribution during the war effort, and so they are quite capable of being able to vote. Another very interesting strategy is that the papers quoted local and regional suffrage supporters. So they interviewed national anti-suffrage leaders, but local and regional suffrage supporters, which is very interesting. And we all know that people like to read about local people in the press. So this was a very fascinating discovery. Okay. So overall, my themes were that the press tended to use more episodic versus thematic framing, which is very common, of course, in our history, where the press was mostly focused on concrete events rather than putting issues into a broader context. They didn't present both sides in a story. There was a lack of verification of these issues. And counter movements in this specific point did focus on a very negative type of rhetoric. So these are things to think about as we cover social movements today. You know, what kind of coverage are we giving to the social movement, to the counter movement? Are we presenting both sides? Are we getting into a deeper context of what this issue is all about? Or are we focused more so on the shallow coverage? Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in, and additional thanks to our sponsor, Texas Christian University. Until next time, I'm your host, Terry Fenneman, signing off with the words of Edward R. Murrow. Good night and good luck.